cliffcentral.com.
Have you ever met someone like that? Like they keep telling you what makes them happy, but they're so miserable. You know, if it makes you happy, why are you so sad? Huh? Come on, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean? Mm. All right, it's 8 minutes after eight. Hopefully, Dr. Makwazikwaza is okay, but we're going to have to, I think, postpone this one until the next available opportunity. Percy has been trying to set her up for weeks now, and it seems just very, very difficult because she's obviously embroiled in all kinds of controversies, and there are people who are making her life a little bit difficult at the moment. I wanted to ask her about her hair.
That is important.
It's very important. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask her about her family, ask her about the SABC inquiry that she was the head of. There's a lot to talk to her about. You know what? I'm proud that there are brave and courageous people in politics in South Africa, even within the ANC, who are prepared to stand up for what is principally good and who are prepared to stand up against things like state capture and say what they really think, even if it makes them unpopular and even if it puts them under threat of all kinds of nastiness. So there's always a good excuse to talk to her and a good reason to have her on. And if we can't get her this morning, then we will get her soon. Right, Sia? We'll keep on working.
I'm kind of disappointed, but it's such a perfect time to speak to her around as well. You know, will she ever run for president? You know, that question has been posed to her before. She says not yet. But I wonder what her time frame is. But yeah, we'll definitely work towards that.
Alrighty, some other stuff that's going on we need to quickly pay attention to. I know that there are a few stories that a lot of people are interested in this morning. One of them that I mentioned to Mubs earlier is Dudu Mieni has decided she's finally going to get out of SAA. I think a lot of people are quite relieved about that, especially SAA.
Yeah, so did she decide this herself, or was
Who knows?
Did somebody say to her, now listen?
I think there was huge pressure mounting. And I think that it's because I read it and I thought, I need to check my sources on this because I don't believe she's actually left. But there we go. That's what we've got. Apparently, Malusi Gigaba confirmed that SAA wrecking ball Dudu Mieni is out.
Is that what we're calling her?
Well, that's what she did to the airline. So there we go. She's going to have to find something else to do with her time now.
Yeah. And how fruitful does your CV look after a situation like this?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think in this country it matters because it's who you're friends with.
That's a sad reality. So she's not going to be, you know, down and out, and we're not going to see her at the robots begging for change.
There'll be a new board chair appointed at the SAA AGM in August. That much we know. All right. Anything else you want to throw in?
No.
Well, it's about what exactly we want to discuss because...
Let me just throw forward to this so people know what's going on.
Yes.
Anna Dudek was one of the women on the panel with me. She was the only woman on the panel that we hosted in Bonn at the Global Media Forum. She's a Polish journalist, and she spent some time with us here in South Africa last week. She came out on a trip, and I sat down with her in the studio, and we had a really interesting discussion about Poland, about the similarities between Poland and South Africa, about free speech, about journalism, about her own family, her own background, and we will be sharing that discussion with you in the next couple of minutes.
The beauty of a pre-recorded interview in times like these.
We try to keep things together for you.
So I know you're going to already roll your eyes at the story. But last week we briefly discussed The Rock, who has already registered his whole campaign.
Sounds like he might actually run for president.
Mm. His campaign for 2020. And do you know who else has now spoken about running for public office?
Selena Gomez.
You know,
really?
I mean, at this stage, it really could be any of those celebrities.
It really could.
Any one of them.
The Olsen twins?
Hey, nope, not
the
them either.
Twins in the presidency?
Jay-Z on behalf of Sir and Rumi.
These are, you know, these options that you guys are giving me here would make me feel more comfortable than who's currently being taking this very seriously.
Who?
And that is Caitlyn Jenner.
Oh, for God's sake. Really? How,
we're not even surprised, right? We're not shocked anymore.
But it does make me laugh.
So she's quoted by saying recently, "I have considered it. I like the political side of it. The political side of it has always been very intriguing to me. So over the next 6 months or so, I have to find out where I can do a better job. So can I do a better job from the outside, kind of working the perimeter of the political scene, being open to talk to anyone? Or are you better off from the inside? And we are in the process of determining that." So she also confirmed that she will most certainly run as a Republican, given her outspoken support for the party. Now, this is the second time she's raised this. She actually raised a first little hint back in April. And really? Hey, here you go.
Okay, so I found an interview with Caitlyn Jenner and Tucker Carlson on Fox News. Yeah. The reason I'm going to play this for you is because Caitlyn hasn't really thought through her answers to any of these questions. No. A question came up about a transgender woman who took part in the Olympics against a bunch of other girls. The transgender woman had a huge physical advantage because she used to be a man, so she had male physical.
Big muscles.
Right. Yeah. This is a biological thing. This has got nothing to do with gender identity, which is something that people like Caitlin struggle to answer in a meaningful way. I want you to hear this because it's kind of, to me, it shows that there's, it's all ideology. It's all what Rich was talking about just now, identity politics, and it's got nothing to do with what's actually going on in biology and in the physical world.
It's not something that's just a whim.
Just to be clear, I would never argue it was done on a whim. I don't believe that, and I didn't mean to suggest that. But I do think that there are real-life issues around this question. And here's one of them. It has to do with sports, something that you know obviously very well. A transgender woman just won a major weightlifting title. Yeah. And some people said, well, this is someone who has a massive physical advantage over the other entrants in that contest. And that seemed like a real thing to me.
We're kind of getting off the subject of what I talk about in the book, because the talk about in the book is about my journey. But
of course,
to answer that, the Olympic Committee is way ahead of the rest of the world when it comes to dealing with identifying transgender issues and competing. All the way back when I was competing in the 70s, all the women had saliva tests to make sure their DNA, that they were female, because we had the East German women and the Soviet women.
When he says East German, sorry, when she says East German women, she like opens her eyes like, there was something going on there. I'm like, this is double irony because you shouldn't be raising an eyebrow to the East German women, Caitlin. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So hang on, listen to her answer here.
All that kind of stuff. Well, since then, there has been a lot of kind of gender nonconforming. We don't quite know where they fit into the athletic world. And the Olympic Committee has done 20 years of studies on issues of hormone levels, of whether you need gender confirmation surgery, what can you do as a trans person to be able to compete as your authentic self?
Right.
And they've come up with guidelines. You meet those guidelines, you can compete. And obviously this woman did.
Do you think it's fair to the other girls?
Yes, I think it's totally
competing?
Fair. The Olympic Committee thinks it's fair. I'm fine with it, yes.
Great.
Yeah, because there's no issue, no big advantage.
There's no, well, there's a, of course, a no, physical, well, in that case, there was a big physical advantage.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to get into all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Physical
advantage.
Well,
so clearly shuts, did you hear that argument? It just went boom, dead end.
Yeah, look, I mean, Caitlin, obviously, she's got a side that she's chosen and she sticks by it.
Right.
And that's just the way it goes.
Okay. Well, there we are. All right, that's pretty much all we got time for this morning, because I want to get to this interview with Anna Dudek from Poland, who was at the Global Media Forum with me. I thought you might like to hear what she has to say about her own country, the things that are going on there. And there's always breaking news in some corner of the world, and I don't think we pay attention to all of it because we don't have the attention to pay to all of it. But what's going on in Poland should concern anybody who believes in free speech and the rights of ordinary citizens in a government that's increasingly on the right rather than on the left of conventional wisdom. And they seem to have just played host to Donald Trump a little while ago, and he was very warmly received. Take a listen to this. CliffCentral.com, 17 minutes after 8. Anna Dudek is the editor of Oko Press in Poland, and she's someone I met on a trip to Bonn recently in Germany, where we were both on a panel.
at the Global Media Forum to discuss polarized societies and the job of media in those polarized societies. Got talking to Anna. Turns out that she was on her way to South Africa. We both didn't know this at the time, but a couple of weeks later. And she's here in Johannesburg to talk to us about all the things that she does in Poland, about what's happening in media in Poland, and about the possible correlations between what goes on there and what's happening here. So Anna, it's very nice to see you.
Very nice to see you as well. Thanks.
It's a surprise.
Yeah, it is a big surprise.
What are you actually doing in South Africa?
Well, I flew in with KLM, who is presenting a new program for Amsterdam-Johannesburg flights. So they were kind enough to invite me on that trip, which was amazing.
Very, very good. And you live in Warsaw?
I live in Warsaw, yeah.
So you're born in Poland?
I was born and raised in Poland, yes.
Okay, tell me about Poland.
What would you like to know?
Well, tell me about what kind of a country it is, what sort of people there are there, what's your political situation, the kinds of things that I think South Africans might be interested in.
Well, since I'm a journalist, I think I'll start with a political angle. Well, since the last election, which was 2 years ago, and that was the election that Law and Justice Party won peace, Prawo I Sprawiedliwość in Polish, that situation has turned a little dark in terms of freedom of speech and so on, and some civil rights. And at the time, Amnesty International and European Union are watching Poland and the situation there very closely, which for journalists and for people who live there, it's just a little difficult at the time.
I believe Donald Trump just visited Poland.
Yes, indeed.
And there was some kind of controversial situation where it looked like in a video clip the Polish First Lady didn't shake his hand.
We don't know whether she did that on purpose or not, but it did. It was a big hit on the Polish and international media, so it became a meme. And she usually doesn't talk much. She's in the shade of her husband, President Andrzej Duda, and she's criticized for it. When the ruling party wanted to change the abortion law, women in Poland, not only women, were mad at her because she didn't take a stand. She remained silent. So this was seen as a bit of maybe significant gesture from her part, maybe, hopefully.
Do you think that maybe the criticism was still bothering her and that's why she didn't do it? Or do you think it was just a mistake?
It's really hard to tell because we don't really know her.
Right.
She remains silent. All she's known for is her colorful dresses, basically. So, yeah, that's the First Lady of Poland. She does some charity work. But as for political views and stance, we don't really know what she thinks.
You just brought up, and we didn't have to go straight into the heavy stuff, but I do think it's important. There was a proposition on the table that Poland was going to make abortions illegal.
Yes.
And the women of Poland actually stood together and managed to get that reviewed.
Exactly. Last year in October, we organized ourselves and thousands of women marched the streets in Warsaw in different cities. It was called a Black March. And the government got scared because, you know, you can't mess with women. And I think that's something that Donald Trump is learning as well, hard way.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it's a mostly Catholic country.
Very Catholic.
So abortion is obviously considered to be something that's religiously problematic. And of course, the former Pope, John Paul II, came from Poland. And so there's a very strong connection to the Vatican, and there's some very traditional Catholics there. So I imagine for women to stand up and do this would have been difficult.
You know what's amazing? It's not only atheists or non-religious women or feminists who got out on the streets. It was also the women who are Catholic, who are from the right side, let's put it this way. So this shows that there's great power and potential, and we actually can get over our differences when the stakes are so high. And this is high because this is, you know, women deciding about their not only their bodies, but their lives, basically. And I don't think that any politician or any priest or whoever really has the right to decide for me. And this is a view that is shared by thousands of women in Poland, not only in Poland, probably. So, yeah, we are proud that that turned out the way it did.
Awesome. That's good to hear, because, you know, sometimes we think that because of the history of Poland, and we'll go into that in a moment or two, but a lot of people imagine that the Polish people are just so browbeaten through history and have been given such a raw deal that they often will just accept things instead of...
On the contrary, we're fighters, you know, and throughout history, you can see it very clearly. I mean, during the communism, before communism, we fight.
Yeah. Well, there's stories that I want to look at in a moment, but I'm interested in the change in Poland. Obviously, you're young. You weren't there when Poland became a communist country, but you might have still dealt with, when you were younger, some of the leftovers of communism.
Of course.
What do Polish people feel about that period of their history, post World War II, and Russian sort of authority over the country, and the whole Eastern Bloc philosophy, and the fact that, you know, this was imposed on them? They didn't have a say, really.
You know, the Polish and Russian relations go back centuries and have never been good, really. And Poland, I think, has always felt, in a way, overwhelmed, occupied also, and that was actually it happened because we did lose our independence for 123 days, and Russia was a big part of that deal. So there was a lot of this negative sentiment, and of course, you know, after the war, we basically went from being under one occupation to being under another, which lasted for over 50 years. So you will meet people who feel nostalgic about communism because, you know, they had jobs and they had secure careers in a way. Mm. But the dominant sentiment, I think, is that it was oppression, that we were deprived of our freedom, our dignity, our privacy, basically, which obviously had a different consequences as well, because when you have such an authoritarian government, at least not in Poland, you don't just go with it. You organize people, you have underground structures. It happened in Poland. I mean, certain books were prohibited, so publishers were either forced to close publishing houses. So what they did, they went underground and created this, it was called Drugi Obieg in Polish, which was, you couldn't buy them in the bookstores, just under the table. And it was super, it was dangerous, you know. They had hidden publishers and hidden, what you call, printing houses. Everything was done in the dark, basically. People, you know, donate money, and they would just, with their own hands, make these books.
It's incredible.
And they would travel across the country with those, you know, packages of books that were illegal. So I wasn't a part of it. I just admire these people.
What did your father and mother do? What do they do? What's your family background?
Well, my dad is a judge. And my mom is also a lawyer. She doesn't practice law anymore. She has her own company. Mm-hmm. And my sister is a lawyer as well.
And they obviously practiced all of their different law skills during the old regime.
My
as well.
Dad did. My mom is a bit younger, and she graduated from the law school after the fall of the communism in the 90s.
So was your father a judge under the old communist government?
Yes, he was.
Wow.
Yes,
that must have been interesting.
For sure. And, you know, sometimes when I tell people, and they know how old my dad is, he's almost 70 now, they look at me, they give me this look like, oh, really? So he was working under that regime.
Yeah.
He must have been, you know, involved. And I look back at them because I know my dad and I know how, you know, honest and crystal basically he is and how good of a man and a judge and a lawyer he is. So, but this is a part of the bigger picture. There's a huge debate going on and it's been going on for years. If you were a policeman or a prosecutor or a judge or a journalist during that time, certain forces, political forces, want you to, get completely transparent or basically resign. So it's like, okay, so if you are a doctor and you got your degree in the 70s,
you're meant to just ignore it and start from scratch.
I mean, come on, there's no logic in it.
We've got a similar situation in South Africa where there were a lot of judges. Some of them were activist judges. They were progressive. They wanted to change things for the better. And a lot of those judges got into trouble under the old regime. And then when the transition happened, they found themselves in a good position. And others who were conservative and ended up not wanting to practice afterwards, not wanting to be on the bench afterwards. But I suppose it comes down to you've got the space and time and you've got to try and make the most of it. It must have been interesting for him, though, to have seen the transition and to have seen how the law changed from communism into what Poland is now.
Definitely. He doesn't talk much about that. Because back then he was practicing criminal law and now he's in a different field.
Mm.
But what I think is interesting is that, the changes that are happening now. I'm going back to today's situation because I think the more we talk about what's happening in Poland now, the bigger are chances that something will be changing in a different direction. And the situation right now is that the ruling party, Law and Justice, is taking over courts, is changing the law, is persecuting judges, calling them, you know, this establishment elite.
Mm.
And partially it's probably true because these are very well educated people.
Mm.
But, I mean, once they have the courts, this is a done deal, and they've already done it with the Constitutional Court. So, yeah, and I talked to my dad about it, and he says that he will be retiring because he can't take it. He can't.
Really?
Yes. This is how bad it is. Also, they they want to, X-ray those lawyers, mostly judges, prosecutors as well, who worked during communism.
Huh.
And of course, if you are 70 or 60, you did
you will
work.
Have been there, yeah.
And they want to cut down their pension.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is all happening.
What is, you mentioned how things are now, and obviously free speech and free expression is under threat in Poland to a degree. I mean, probably more than even in South Africa. We had this discussion.
Yeah, we talked about it.
What is Oko Press? What is that all about?
Oko Press is a fact-checking platform. It was created by Piotr Pacewicz, who previously worked for Gazeta Wyborcza, which is the biggest Polish daily. It was established in 1989, before the first election, free election.
Mm-hmm.
And Gazeta Wyborcza means the newspaper, election newspaper. The name of the title remained the same.
Mm-hmm.
What we do, we fact check, double, triple, quadruple fact check politicians, what they say, what they promise, what they do. We follow the legislation processes and we do investigations. There's a special unit in the office, it's called Spotlight, and they do amazing work. These are dedicated journalists who know how to investigate, and they get great results.
Well, here we've got a couple of people, like we've got a group called Scorpio and Amabungani, who do exactly the same thing. They look into corruption in government, corruption in private business, criminal activities, and all of that stuff. They do thorough and incredible detailed work.
I admire this kind of field of work and this journalist because it is incredible. And without it, where would we be?
Well, we'd be lied to by governments.
Very much.
So do you have no trust at all in your government in terms of their ability to tell the truth or to be
Not
at all?
Not at all. I see it every day. I watch the news. I listen to the news. I work in the news. And I don't remember the last time I heard something that was partially true.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty awful. I mean, our government lies a lot. And there's huge corruption. But sometimes they tell the truth.
See, what's what's interesting here is that this party, Law and Justice, they were elected and they gained popularity playing this anti-communism sentiment.
Uh-huh.
But now that they're in power, they're doing exactly the same thing. They're using the same methods when it comes to propaganda and so on. They turned the national media into propaganda tube.
That's kind of what's happened with our SABC as well. And you see now the correlation between South Africa and Poland.
I think there are many of those.
I think so. Tell me about the population of Poland in terms of immigration statistics, in terms of sort of dominant demographics so that we can figure out from a South African point of view, because unfortunately, South Africans probably don't know a huge amount about Poland, certainly not the average South African.
Well, of course, you know.
So what have we got?
It's always more interesting to, you know, to what's happening locally. And the same, I think, in Poland as well, or in Great Britain or wherever.
Anyway, yeah.
Well, there are 40 million people in Poland. And, you know, Poland is very homogenic.
So, in other words, most of the people look the same.
Yes.
They're mostly white people.
They're mostly white Catholic people. And when it comes to immigration, well, the biggest group is the Ukrainians who come to Poland because, I don't know if you know.
They've got massive destabilizing factors.
I mean, what's going on in Ukraine and
Russia
war.
Russia is constantly predating upon them.
You know, what happened with Crimea. So, but even before that, I mean, historically, we had a large immigration from Ukraine and it's mostly motivated economically.
Mm.
So, it's probably about a million people, I think. I would have to check the statistics, and I'll give you an example how the authorities lie about it. So they are, because, of course, in Europe, we are talking about the...
And you're in the European Union, to be clear here as well. So Poland's in probably the most right-leaning country in the European Union. Might be, huh?
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
That, it's
or
hard to
maybe,
say, you know?
Maybe Hungary.
Yeah, we are. There's actually a saying in Polish that kind of symbolizes how close we are historically with the Orban's country, with Hungary. And yes, definitely there are many similarities between our prime minister and well, what's funny, we have a prime minister who is a woman, Beata Szydło, but. Who is actually in power is Jarosław Kaczyński, who is the leader of Law and Justice Party. So he's basically driving from the back seat.
And he's got a front in her.
Yeah.
She's just there as a window dressing.
So Kaczyński and Orban are very, very similar, very close. They, I mean, what's happening in Hungary with the press and certain fields of public life, it's mirrored in Poland.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not looking good. But what I was going to tell you about the immigration.
Yes.
We had this huge debate in Europe about the refugee crisis. And of course, there are different opinions, points of view. But how they use it politically. So they say, oh, in Poland we took in so many refugees because every country is obligated by European Union to take in certain quotas. And they say, we have a million refugees from Ukraine. And this is just, you know, deliberately lying because there's a difference in the status between a refugee and an immigrant. But the public opinion doesn't have to know it. It's their job to explain these differences.
So why would they inflate that to make it seem there's a big problem when there isn't?
Well, you know, that's what populists do. They are playing the fear because, you know, as we said, Poland is like a monolith. White, mostly Catholic people.
So how many, you talk about the refugee crisis, and I think you obviously refer to Syria here and to the situation in most of Europe where there's concern over immigration into Europe from Syria. Does Poland also have to take in Syrian refugees?
There is a debate in certain circles about it. We should, because that was established in certain summits of European Union. But they don't want to.
And this Law and Justice Party, obviously, are very anti-immigrant.
Yes, in their narrative, they're very similar to National Front in France.
Right, so run by Marine Le Pen.
Yeah,
right.
So but all these populists, they have, let's call them neo-populists. That's what they have in common. They use the fear in politics. They scare people and they pretend like there is a threat and they pretend they're going to be the saviors. And in this case, in this narrative, this stranger, this threat, that's mostly this refugee being seen as a Muslim, in Poland, the attitude towards Islam and Muslim people is very, very hostile.
How many Muslims do you have in Poland?
Not very many. It's maybe 50,000. So it's a very, very small percentage. And, you know, these are not violent people. These are not terrorists. I mean, in many communities, you have people who are easily radicalized, obviously. So you have to keep a close eye. If there's, an idea that someone can be easily radicalized, but you can put that kind of filter on the whole community because it's just hurting people.
You actually wrote a book about Muslim women.
I actually wrote a book about Muslim women.
Tell me about that.
About Muslim women or the
Your book? Your book. And the things you would have discovered with Muslim women in Poland.
Well, you know, I was looking for a topic to write about, and all of a sudden it was just there. I was on the bus, and I saw this 5 or 6 Chechen women. They were wearing hijabs. I mean, you could tell that they were Muslims. And there were 2 guys sitting there, drunk. And they were just calling them names, and it turned violent, and no one reacted. These were just, you know.
But these 2 guys became violent towards these 2 women?
Yes.
Towards these 5
verbally
women?
Verbally and physically afterwards. So I'm sitting there, and I was talking to these girls, and they're just going back to the refugee center after a hard day of work. And they were being, you know, yelled at and spat on, and no one reacted. So I thought, this is something that is happening. No one is paying any attention. And I think as a journalist, it is my job to talk about these things if no one else will. And I started looking for women I could talk to. And I didn't really have any criteria, you know. I talked to refugees from Iraq. I talked to women who converted. I have one that is from Bosnia who had to flee the country from the Milosevic regime. I have Tatar women who, this is a community, Muslim community that has lived in Poland for over 500 centuries. And it was an amazing journey thanks to them because, you know, I'm not religious. So, and maybe it was easier because of that. Maybe it was harder for them to open up. But if you talk to a Muslim woman, it's a given that she won't be very, open at first. Because the media have repeatedly hurt them in many ways. I mean, depicting, showing them as, you know, radical, crazy fundamentalists.
Or as just, you know, chattel and possessions with no brains.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So, you know, this, to be honest, it pissed me off because every single piece of news or article or a panel, they would talk about Muslims or Muslim women, but there was no Muslim women. I mean, you can talk about, you know, journalists without journalists there. So I thought, no, if you people don't want to talk to them, I want to talk to them. And they were suspicious at first because, you know, it's, what do you want? You know, they thought I was looking
for... What bad things are you going to say about me?
They thought I was looking for scandal, maybe, which I wasn't. But I think through talking to them, and with some of them we made friends, and it's been beautiful. But they changed the way I think about religious Catholic women as well, or people in general. So it was a long journey, and I usually get this question. So what do you think about these Muslim women? Are they, they have basically no brain, no will, no privileges, nothing. And I say, are you describing a Catholic woman or a Muslim woman or just a dumb woman?
Or a Stepford wife in America who's just there to keep her husband
happy. So, you know, it's so easy to judge. And some of these girls are highly educated. I mean, they say that some of them are feminists, but they call themselves, I mean, their feminism comes from Quran. And some say that Prophet Muhammad was the first feminist because he was actually the one who gave women rights. And with, I mean, I'm not praising the religion.
Sure, Islam has got its problems.
Of course.
But in Poland, this is not the biggest problem. So I would imagine two things happening. Correct me if I'm wrong. First of all, I think that probably people on the right in Poland would have thought your book was bullshit and that you were looking for attention. And that
I got a lot of that attitude.
How dare you be talking to these radical, dangerous people? Yeah. And then from the other side, there must have been a lot of, as you say, suspicion in the beginning. And then later on, that it may have opened people's eyes. It may have given them a chance to inspect the lives of these fellow human beings in a way that didn't make them other.
That was my hope, and I hope maybe in some way or some ways it worked that way, because that's why I wrote it, you know. It's a good story, obviously, and from what I heard, it's well written. But, I mean, it tells us something, I think, important about us, not only them, but also about us, how judgmental and how un-Catholic can we be.
Well, I'm curious too. You've had an interesting life. You spent a lot of time in Italy.
Yes, I did.
Do you want to explain what you were doing in Italy and where you want to go and all these things? Because we had a long chat the one night after our panel, and you said that you almost took up a post in Lebanon, among other things. But let's start with Italy.
Well, I was studying journalism and political science in Warsaw. And I got this idea that I'd like to go on a scholarship to Italy, where I haven't been before. So I learned the language and I went.
You learned, your Italian is very good. I've heard you speak.
It's fluent now, but it's, you know, after having lived for 2 years in Italy. But I mean, I did learn a bit while still in Poland, and then it got polished when I was living there with the Italian people and was attending Italian classes at the university. And it was amazing. It is second home, you know. Rome is just one of those cities that just embrace you.
Magic. And did you want to stay there? Did you want to work there permanently?
You know, I did, and I tried, but life in Rome is so good, and the coffee is so delicious, and the wine flows, and the food, and the people, and the sky, and the building, and the history. It's so beautiful that, you know, the Stendhal syndrome, he went to Florence and he got so overwhelmed that he got sick. So you can get that like every day in Rome. So some great writers, you know, were there.
So did it annoy you to have to go back to Poland? Because, you know,
it was a tough decision.
Most people love their country that they come from. for whatever reason. Some people just do because it's what they're expected to do. But it sounds to me almost like you are an adventurer. You want to be in different places and doing different things.
Definitely.
You don't feel trapped by home.
Definitely.
Do you love Poland?
That is a very hard question. I do love Poland. I don't like what's happening right now in my country, but I do love Poland. And that's partially, you know, why I do what I do. Why I'm a journalist. Mm. Because it's important to me to improve the quality of, the public sphere. I would like to talk to people. I would like to, you know, what we lack is just this, some platforms, some space, safe space to talk. I mean, I'm a liberal journalist, and even the liberal media, they do not invite people with different views and opinions to talk, and without dialogue, we'll be out in the streets in 5 years.
And you'll be doing exactly what you're told, like slaves. That's what governments want.
Yes.
They want people who don't think for themselves,
so
who are
obedient.
So
we need to talk. I mean, yeah. Left and right, we have to talk. We have our differences, obviously.
Sure.
I'm not going to become all of a sudden pro-life volunteer. Hmm. But I want to hear the arguments they have, you know. I want to... we talked about it. Hmm. And... yeah, and I think it made me think, actually, because in our previous conversation, you said that you'd rather have, racists and radical people get out there in the social media and, tell what they think.
Even if it's offensive and disgraceful and hurtful.
Because it's better to know.
And well, you know what you're dealing with. You know, you can fight an enemy that you can see.
And I agree. So let's talk. And... there's no space for dialogue, and we're aiming at creating that kind of space.
Well, I think sometimes that all humans all over the world have their challenges, and sometimes they're very similar. You know, we look at some countries and we think, oh, it must be enviable to live in a country where the media is free. But if you look at things like what's going on with Trump and CNN at the moment, if you look at how...
Oh, it's fake news.
Of course. I mean, that's all he says about anything he doesn't agree with. And America really is the country that has come as close as I think it's possible to be where the press is free. Certainly mm-hmm. they're allowed to ask the president any question. You know, it's becoming complicated there, without a doubt. But we always think, oh, you know, our country's worse off. Certainly in South Africa, people always go, oh, we don't really have a free press. I think we've got a freer press than in Poland. I think we've got a freer press than in Malaysia. I think we've got a freer press than in Turkey, certainly.
Well, I can't say much about the South African press market because, you know, this is my second day here.
Sure,
and I intend to deepen my knowledge, but...
no, I don't expect you to be an expert in 2 days, I promise. Maybe in three.
Okay, deal. But it is true that, you know, Poland in this free speech index done by Reporters Without Borders, Poland has fallen down by, I think, 20 positions. And while South Africa climbed up. Hmm. So it shows something. And, you know, I don't see Reporters Without Borders or Amnesty International, looking closely at Johannesburg or Cape Town and the press there. And that's happening in Warsaw. So that's just something we have to do about it.
You want to be posted to interesting places and do interesting work all over the world. And you mentioned that you mentioned to me that you'd almost taken up a post in Lebanon.
I did.
And there was a man involved.
Gareth, come on! No.
Come on!
This was off the
record. It's a good story. No. It's a good story. Come on.
Yes, I have a great friend who is Lebanese.
Yeah.
A great reporter. Who was looking for a producer based in the Middle East? And
most women would not take a post in the Middle East.
Well, I don't know about that. Maybe just know different kind of women than I do.
Lebanon, no. I think that a lot of women in the Western world think that it's a dangerous place. And I mean, Lebanon's just across the border from Syria, which is probably the most dangerous country in the world.
There are different types of people. Some people want to be librarians. Some people want to make coffee. Some people want to write books. I fall into
the third. You want to go to war zones.
I fell into the third category. So, of course, I would be, you know, probably terrified. But Lebanon, I mean, Beirut, it's not as dangerous as it's seen.
No, sure.
When you know the locals and when you know what you're doing, it's fine. But at the end, I didn't take the job.
And you, it obviously bothered you that you didn't take the job.
It bothered
because
me.
Because you should have done it, right?
It bothered me, but you know what? If I had taken the job, we wouldn't have met. Yeah. And I wouldn't be staying here talking to you. So, you know,
everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
What do you think so far of what you've seen here?
I haven't seen much. But what I've seen so far has made me, I think, fall in love with the city and South Africa. It's a very unexpected trip. And so a week ago...
First of all, you've come at a terrible time. It's winter.
It's winter and I'm wearing a summer dress. So
yeah,
thank you very much.
Well, how cold does it get in Poland in winter?
Minus 25. Yes, you are invited.
It only gets to 3 degrees here. We consider that freezing.
Okay, once you survived winters in Canada, you're fine with Polish winter. Okay?
Right, you've been in Canada for winter as well. That gets much, much colder.
Very cold.
You don't
and
even
it's
leave
just
the house.
So dry. No, you have to leave the house
right,
because
so
you have to go to
you've
school.
You've come at a terrible time because it's winter. You've come at a terrible time because Johannesburg looks brown and dead and horrible in winter.
It's
awful. And you, the first thing you did was last night you went into Soweto at night and you weren't allowed to get out of the car.
Well, eventually I got out of the car and had delicious dinner there. But I just think it's, you know, fascinating. The city is, I haven't seen much, but it's beautiful. I know, you know, people talk how dangerous it is and the criminality rate and all that and political problems, but it's beautiful and people are so friendly.
Good. I'm
amazed.
Glad to hear that.
I've been chatting to people, you know, that's what I usually do when I travel. I went to the Mandela Square and I was sitting there for a couple of hours talking to people and everyone was just very friendly and very interested in, you know, Europe and Poland. Of course, they thought I was from Holland because it's so similar. It's just very interesting place. And I think it's maybe a beginning of a long-term relationship that I intend to develop with South Africa.
Good. Well, we hope that that happens.
It will happen.
And there are obviously things that we can learn from Poland, and there are probably some things that we could impart to Poland as well. So thank you, Anna. I'm very happy
you're
in South Africa. I hope you enjoy your time here.
Thank you so much.
We'll try to look after you, and we'll talk again soon.
Great. Thank you.
Very good. Anna Dudek. And if you want to know more, Oko Press, they are an investigative journalism business. They're also in the business of publishing. And they try to find out, much like we in South Africa do, what's really going on when the government tell you one story and you know it's not true.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. CliffCentral.com.